Welcome to Building with Brick, foundational wisdom on coaching, careers, and Christ. This leadership podcast was spawned by Coach Brickner's book, So You Want to Be a Coach, which is the story of a corporate executive who made a drastic career change and became a head men's basketball coach. Dr. Brickner's book is available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook on Amazon.com, or go to his website, www.drjoebrickner.com. That's drjoebrickner.com. Now, here's this week's podcast. Welcome back, folks, to part two of our interview with Chris Godfrey. Chris is a Super Bowl champion. He's also an author, president of Life Athletes. At the end of our part one, we were talking about his journey to get to the Super Bowl Giants. And it's fascinating. I heard this summer at a conference that I attended. Chris was one of the main speakers. Chris, I'd really like for you, if you would, kind of share with us what happened after you got out of college and how you eventually got to the pros and eventually to the New York Giants.
Well, it was a slow process because I got cut three times my first 12 months in the NFL. I wasn't drafted, but I thought that since I'm in good shape, I might as well see if I could pick up with the team. And the Redskins offered me a free agent contract, so I went out there. But prior to that, I got in the best shape of my life, put on 20 pounds, ate like a sumo wrestler, lifted and ran all day long. And I was highly motivated and got to training camp. And really the coach's dream, gave every play 110%. And as you know, training camps in the NFL are no day at the beach. He's had two or three practices a day. Training camps were much longer before the salary cap, you know, 6 to 8 weeks long. Hottest time of the year, you know, you're away from family and friends and you're all beat up. You had no time to yourself. Any free time was spent, you know, icing yourself and reading the playbook, which is about this thick. And the worst part about it was knowing that all this hard work is likely for nothing because you're just a free agent who's here just to make the lines longer for the veterans so they could get a blow between drills, right? And so, but I hung with it because I really wanted it. And by the end of the preseason, everybody was talking about how it was going to make the team. Even the press was talking about it.
You were defensive lineman at the time?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and Jack Pardee was the head coach. He played for a long time, too. He was a member of George Allen's Over the Hill gang.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so a lot of those guys were still on the team, you know. A bunch of old pirates, right? Especially the defensive line. Very colorful defensive lineman room I was in. I should have made the team, but I got cut. Turns out many years later, I found that the head coach, I wasn't able to get the spot I wanted because it was occupied by the head coach's buddy. It was actually his best man at his wedding many years before they played together. But it was crushing, you know, to work as hard as I did and not get it. It was really tough. It was tough stuff. And then about 2 weeks into the season, the Jets gave me a call and went out there. And I spent the year backing up Joe Klecko and Mark Gastineau and the famous New York Sack Exchange there. And the day before I went out to the next training camp at Hofstra University, I injured my knee in a kind of a freak accident. So I got out to training camp and I couldn't practice. And so I was cut a week or so later. And I took the long drive home from Hofstra University out on Long Island back to Detroit, Michigan. Got home late. Everybody was in bed, but I found a note next to the telephone saying the Green Bay Packers had called. And I realized that the Packers had just signed the new position coach who had been my position coach the year before with the Redskins. And I said, oh, Doc and I are friends. You know, I must have a legitimate shot at making this team. You wouldn't be wasting my time. So I decided to give football one more try. And so I got up to Green Bay. I was there for a week or two. And they told me I made the team. I said, yes. You know, I called home. My dad, my girlfriend, my sister, they brought up my car and my clothes for the season. They stayed for the last preseason game. And then they went home. And the next morning at the Midway Motor Lodge across the street from Lambeau Field, I got a phone call, a wake-up call from a Green Bay Packers assistant coach, the one they called the Turk, because he was the one in charge of calling people to let them know the bad news. And that's what he did. That, you know, they sorry, you know, but they had drafted a quarterback in the first round who wasn't ready to be the backup yet. And we need to give him your spot. And we're going to have to let you go. So I was, I just hung up the phone and I fell to my knees without even thinking about it. And I said, Lord, I give up. You know, whatever you want me to do, wherever you want me to go, you're the boss now. And I never prayed like that before. You know, I was, at least in my mind, I thought I was a good Catholic guy. I went to Mass on most Sundays, that sort of a thing. But whenever I had a decision to make, you know, whether to do things my way or to do things God's way, I usually found a way to rationalize doing it my way. You know, imagine that. But now it was very plain to me that my way wasn't working. And I decided to give God's way a chance. So I really meant that prayer. Anyways, I packed up my bags, went across the street, got my final physical, and I'm heading out the front door when Bart Starr, the head coach at the time, called me into his office and apologized for cutting me and asked me to stay. He put me on the injured reserve. And I was flabbergasted. You know, I'd been around the NFL long enough to know that they just didn't make rash, dumb mistakes like that. And every night they talk about who are these lucky 50 guys or so that are going to make our roster spots. And so I knew that God had a hand in the whole thing and that he was close to me. And because of that, I wanted to get closer to him. So that was really the beginning of a turnaround in my life. And I look back now, you know, at the ripe old age of what, 22, 23, turnaround in my life. But it seemed like a big turnaround at that time. And so a whole new way of looking at things, and it became a real period of growth for me. And being in Green Bay, especially during the off season, was almost like a retreat experience. There's not a lot going on other than lifting. But I did get a chance. They had a speaker's bureau, so I would go out. They would actually give us a few bucks to be like PR agents and go out and give talks to different places all around Wisconsin. So I did a little of that, and I would share with people that experience that I just had. And so that really became the beginning of my getting involved with Life Athletes and starting that many years later. But all of that turnaround that God used in football to let me know that I wasn't as great as I thought I was, that I couldn't do everything on my own. And that's a truism, not just for 22-year-old football players. That's a truism for a 63-year-old guy who's looking at our world today, isn't it? That God has a plan. It's not my plan. All I can do is take that next right step. And I shouldn't fret about the other stuff. And when I am finding myself fretting about that sort of stuff, I know that I need to pull back and go in a different direction. So all of this was the time that God used to get my attention. And I really did my best to follow him. There's actually a point there in Green Bay where I said, Lord, I'm here. Let's take me now. Why mess around with the next 60 years? And I had a sense, you know, my imagination said, no, you're here for a reason. And I got work for you to do. And so got cut the next year. With the Packers, I think I separated my shoulder and training camp, so they cut me anyways. And the whole league went on strike in 82. Nobody was working. I'm standing on an unemployment line back in Detroit, engaged to be married at this point. And you'd think I'd be pretty depressed about my prospects, but really not. It gave me an opportunity to grow in my relationship with the Lord. You know, I wasn't as busy. It was even a more of a retreat than being up in Green Bay. But then a new football league got formed, right? Called the USFL, United States Football League, and they had a team right there in my home town of Detroit called the Michigan Panthers. And they came calling, and I kept telling them, no, I'm getting married. I got to get a real job. Football hasn't been very, very good to me. But they had a coach who was on that original Washington Redskins staff, who was also one of Coach Leahy's lads with the famous Irish teams back in the 40s, late 40s. big old cigar chomping coach who coached at every level of most every team. It'd be easier to say which team he didn't coach for than to say which ones he did. And he went to bat for me in negotiations with the general manager and got me a guaranteed contract.
Wow.
Yeah, I guaranteed $30,000 a year. And you know what? The money wasn't there, but you know what? I knew I was going to get it, which was really unusual in professional football. So my plan was to play one more year and get on with my life. Well, we won that. I switched positions, went to offensive tackle, left tackle. Was pretty not very good to begin with, but those feet that I learned, those good feet that I learned to practice in basketball, really paid off. And they knew that that was an asset. And a left tackle on the offensive lines, really important because that's where the other team's best pass rusher is, which is usually the blind side of the right-handed quarterback. I got my first third and long situation on the league's first televised game. The whole world wanted to watch what this USFL was all about. And the first third and long, I drop back to defend our quarterback, and the guy beats me to the inside and sacks our quarterback. Oh, God. But things got better after that. We won the championship that year after going like 0-6 to start with. But Bobby Hebert was our quarterback, and we had a lot of other good players that all came together. We won the championship that year. And the next year I signed a contract with the New York Giants, jumping back into the NFL, this time as a true free agent, won the right guard spot with the Giants. And 2 years later, 3 years later, we won Super Bowl 21. Seems like a lifetime there. It was only over a span of a few years. I ended up playing 9 years, 9 seasons overall. And after getting cut 3 times that first 12 months. So, very fortunate and learned a lot through all of that.
How big were you when they moved you over to the offensive line? Did you put on like another 20 or 30 or 40 pounds?
No, it was kind of hard because I remember this league kind of got put together on the fly and I wasn't really expecting to be going to training camp in January. And so I was probably the same. I was probably 255, 250 now and, you know, 6'3". Big enough, but not great. But the offensive line really suited me, and I kind of self-taught. And that's one of the things that make offensive linemen, because you might not have a lot of natural skills, but you can make yourself better if you're willing to put the time into practice. And I remember once with the Giants, I was trying to get down make my pulling more efficient and quicker. And that's all footwork, and that's, you know, balancing your weight and your stance. And I'd come out to practice and work on it early just to have it down, because with the Giants, I was the pulling guard. I was kind of like all of that defensive aggressiveness Parcells put to good use on their pulling guard. And I loved it. And I was pretty well suited to the task. But our coach, Ron Earhart, you might remember him. He coached the Patriots head coach for a while, but he coached in the league forever. Anyways, he came out once. He said, you know, the only other offensive lineman or player I ever coached that doing what you are doing right now was John Hanna. Remember John Hanna?
Oh, yeah.
Like
yeah.
All-time all-pro guard. Was he Ohio State? All right. Yeah. But he was like the prototypical guard. Anyways, to hear that kind of really made me feel good. And then something else that made me feel good at the time, but even better, was the great coach Bill Belichick. You know, after that first season of injecting me in the offensive line, Bill was the defensive guru for the Giants, and the Giants always had a great defense with Lawrence Taylor and company, but they never had much of an offense. You know, you need to have both to win, and the defense would really get ticked off. They're back on the field again, and there was actually a little bickering between the sides and all. But I knew I was doing a good job or had a good season after getting into the offensive line, because we finally had a running game going with Joe Morris is doing a great job for us. But anyways, Belichick came up to me after the season and says, you did a really good job for us this year.
Wow.
And that was from the defensive coordinator. So yeah, it did. It encouraged me.
It's interesting you talk about transferring some of the skills that you learned in basketball and helping you in football. I didn't play basically any other sports after high school other than basketball. And just recently, I took up jiu-jitsu. It's absolutely amazing how the footwork that you learn in basketball transfers so directly into jiu-jitsu. You know, he shows us all these different moves and everything, and it's all about footwork and, you know, how to pivot, how to reverse pivot and all these things. I've been able to pick it up probably quicker than I would have had I not been a basketball player. Plus, it's really fun to hit something, you know. Just, oh, God, it feels so good sometimes.
And you don't have to run up and down the court either.
That's right. That's right.
You have a longer career.
When I was, I coached for 12 years at the college level after I retired from business when I was 50 years old. One of the things I used to come home and usually complain about to my wife was players make plays. You know, I won't say we didn't have some players that made plays, but it seemed like more often than not, we needed a play to be made and it wasn't made. And I just come home and I say, oh, I was so used to playing with guys over the years who would, if you needed a key rebounding, they got it, a key steal, you know, a jump shot, they hit it. And it just didn't seem to happen to us when I was coaching. And I'd always come home and I'd say, I need some players to make plays. And she never understood that concept, you know, which if you're in athletics, you do understand those things. But how about your experience, either in college or in pros? Who are some of the guys that you felt were players that made plays?
Initially, what comes to mind is that usually a position that got to touch the ball.
Yeah, that's right.
And initially, I think of Anthony Carter from the University of Michigan. I was a senior when he came in as a freshman, and we were going to lose to Indiana, Lee Corso's Indiana, down to the last few seconds, and we're at midfield. And then John Wangler dropped back to pass, which was the last play of the game, caught AC across the middle, and he made all of them miss after catching the ball and ran another 40 yards. And so that's flat out, in my mind, the play. And then there was another kind of playmaker. I mentioned my teammate Joe Morris. Okay, he was a running back for the Giants, and not a prototypical kind of a running back. But son of a gun, you know, he could squirt through a hole and turn something. It was not unusual for us to be in a third and two situation, and he would get 20 yards. Wow. Okay. He was amazing for that. Somebody else who was on that same team was Tony Galbraith. Kind of a swing pass out to Tony. He was a fullback who's beyond his prime, but he still had moves. And so he was a spot player for us. And he was, I think, maybe the prototypical guy on the team, like the player that would make plays. And he'd only maybe get one or two opportunities a game, right? A specialist, you know, break glass for a player who will make a play. And so this, I remember it too, because it was a play that had me pull around to the far right side and be the lead blocker on the corner. And Tony would be swinging out from a fullback position. And he was kind of a stocky guy. He wasn't, you know. But once he caught the ball, he could make everybody miss. and he pulled us out of so many jams. All I had needed to do was slow down the guy in front of him, and he did the rest. Yeah, and so, you know, players who make plays are ones who kind of like, when I hear that, I think guys can just pull something out, turn it on, okay? And then it's very much the opposite of an offensive lineman, right? Because you got to make all the plays. You have to be consistent. One person just can't break down because everybody's work goes down the drain and just one guy messes up. And it's hard to get everybody firing at 100%, but the more consistent you could be, the better. It's almost like players who won't mess up is better. But those are a couple of guys that really just pop out at my background.
How about the defensive side? Like Lawrence Taylor, would you consider him somebody like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, a big oversight on my part. Certainly Lawrence would be that guy. I remember I was never in the defensive films, but I've heard people like Belichick be sitting there running the tape going, and Lawrence had this great play, just flat out great play, made this play, but it had nothing to do with the play called, the defense that was called or whatever. He just kind of moves into a new position and does something totally unexpected. And Belichick's going, so Lawrence, Well, what did you see there? He goes, I don't know. And so, yeah, so he would be, I guess, at the top of my list of guys making plays. But those are the sort of unpremeditated sorts of things that the defense just reacts. And he did a lot of that.
You played for a lot of different coaches over the years. Do you consider any of those mentors? I know you talked about one that you had in basically middle school. Are there other coaches that you would consider mentors?
Yeah, certainly the Ron Stuckey early on in grade school was a mentor. And I had really, really blessed with good coaches all the way through. You know, I mentioned some of the head coaches, but the assistant coaches that I had are, I mentioned Doc and others. Chuck Knox was another one that I had near the end there. And it was actually my last year in the pros with the Seahawks and Chuck Knox. And he was trying to make a point to the offensive lineman about something, and it just kind of hit me the wrong way. And it made me start to think about the way coaches coach. And they have their, sometimes they're successful in relating to a player, and sometimes they're not. And sometimes it's because, you know, one size doesn't fit all. And so that's, you know, late in my career, my ninth season, that came back to me. What coaches were like this versus, and this is, I praise him for this, was Bill Parcells. I'll never forget the time that we're in our Monday after the Sunday game, had our meetings, we're heading into our day off, everybody's kind of loose. And Parcells is sitting there in the players' lounge drinking a cup of coffee. And he comes up to me and he goes, you know, Godfrey, and we're playing the Philadelphia Eagles, a divisional rival who's having a really good year. I think they were undefeated at this point. And he goes, and the Philadelphia defensive line is the heart of this team. And your guy, and he goes, and your guy's playing better than any of them. And he just walked away. And that's all he had to say.
Yeah.
I was so jacked. And it reminded me that, you know, other guys, you know, needed to get browbeaten, scared to half to death. You better do this, otherwise you're going to hear from me, sort of a thing. But the genius was of Bill is that he was truly a coach. He gave each player what they needed, which gets you into trouble sometimes if you treat people differently. And we might have had that discussion before. And, you know, coach needs to know when to do what. And that's the virtue of prudence. And that's what makes good coaches good coaches.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Super Bowl is going to happen, I think, right after we have this part of your interview. And I won't ask you who you're going to pick between who's going to win. Hopefully the Ohio team. But what was it like for you to be in the locker room before a Super Bowl? Can you kind of describe that? I mean, did anybody act any differently? Are you nervous in there? Or what was that like?
It was a really good experience. I used to go I'd be one of the first to go get to the stadium before the games. And this time it was me and a couple of other guys who are the early birds. We took a cab out there. And as we were coming up the highway, we could see the Rose Bowl off to the distance and the cars and everything pulling up. I remember just kind of smiling. I wasn't nervous at all. It was kind of like, it's almost like a sense of like confidence and what a great opportunity. I'd been here, been there three times before as a Wolverine.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you played in the Rose Bowl and that's where the Super Bowl was. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And so one of the side stories, we're playing the Broncos and one of my buddies from the Michigan team was a Bronco. And so, you know, you have 2 weeks of newspaper articles being printed on every angle of the story going into it. And so one of the angles was, which Wolverine is going to finally win in the Rose Bowl? You know, and so it was me and Mike Harden. So it was kind of like familiar to me, but I felt so just really at ease and confident. And it's kind of different than what you would expect, much different from that first start I had as a Wolverine where I was so nervous I couldn't see straight. Almost like it was, all right, we're here. We've been working our butts off and now we're here. And I think that feeling was shared because one of the guys in the cab with me was Phil Sims, our quarterback. And he set a record for the highest completion rate of any quarterback, and it stood the test of time. I think it still stands. And you only get to those numbers if you're in the zone.
Yeah.
And your offensive line is blocking for you.
Yeah, there you go. And that rings true here. We, I'm a big Kansas City Chiefs fan now that Mahomes is here. Before that, I wasn't that big of a fan. But with Mahomes here, I really am. And he just got butchered last year.
Yeah.
They went out and they built up a good offensive line, and it made a huge difference for him. They take the offensive line for granted. I mean, you guys work your butt off every play. I mean, every play is a war. And if you just sit there and watch and stop watching the quarterback and the receivers, I mean, just watch the linemen, my goodness. And you've got this aggressive guy, big, huge, fast, you know, coming at you, and you got to keep him from getting to your quarterback. What a chore that would be. But how did you go about, I mean, I know your strength and your quickness, those types of things really help, but it takes four or five guys working together to make that work. How did you guys go about becoming a good offensive line?
Well, you're right. Teamwork means a lot, and being able to communicate. And there are instances where a guy's next to you and you don't have that, and it really hurts and it really shows. We were pretty homogeneous in a sense. Parcells, our big jokester coach, liked to give people nicknames. And he gave the offensive line a nickname, you know, but it wasn't like the Monsters of the Midway or the Purple People Eaters. He called his offensive linemen the Suburbanites. That strike fear in your heart. All had names like Christopher and William and Bradley and Bartholomew, and had off-season jobs. We lived out in the suburbs. The kind of guys the mom used to drive to practice in the Squire wagon, that kind of thing.
That is funny.
But that, you know, kind of homogeneous nature, oh, we all could all get along and speak, and that really helped. None of us were really overpowering physically, but we all worked well together, you know, didn't step on each other's feet, and it was really good, and it's really important as an offensive line.
How long did you get to stay together?
Not long, because the year after the Super Bowl, my right-hand man, one of my goals for the season after we won the Super Bowl, is you're looking for goals. You've already been to the mountaintop, so what do you do next, right? We're going to be the best guard-tackle tandem in pro football. That was my thing. And then Carl got diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, and the only reason they caught it was that he had to do get some shoulder work done, and they took a pre-op chest x-ray, and they found it. And so that knocked him out, and that ended that. And a good example of that cohesiveness and how it can be lost so easily. But then the league went on strike, and everything kind of fell apart, went sideways after that.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive, but he had to go through a tough time to get well, and so it was a tough thing, but you know, he came through it and never got a chance to glory in our Super Bowl victory or being teammates for too long. But we the years that we had together were good.
That's too bad. Well, Chris, we're going to take another break here. When we come back, I want to talk about how your faith has influenced you not only in your playing career but after that. And I think it's something that in today's world, I don't know if people are afraid to talk about it or whatever, but I think it's important that people understand and realize that there are a lot of really successful people who are faith-filled, and I know you are. And I'd like to get into that when we come back, if it's all right with you.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks.